disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest with my help.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 been war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s, write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned, for every cop car that ain't been...
Welcome to This Is America, July 3rd, 2021. On today's episode, we launch straight into our discussion, where we tackle how the right has built an AstroTurf campaign around the demonization of critical race theory, and how this relates to a broader attack on basic rights. We then dive into a blow-by-blow of the Biden administration's newly published report on domestic terrorism and what it all means. All this and more, but first, let's get to the news. As cities across the world sweat through record-breaking heat waves, the state continues to attack autonomous movements and struggles attempting to stop the extraction of fossil fuels and destroy the natural environment for profit. In so-called Minnesota, police, in an attempt to finish the drilling of the Line 3 pipeline, set up a barricade on the outskirts of someone's property where water protectors were staying. The resistance camp woke up to Hubbard County handing out a letter stating that they would be barricading the sole access to the camp in 4 hours. As the day wore on, police formed a riot line and attempted to push into the premises. County sheriffs were met with fierce resistance. Hubbard continued to escalate the situation into the night, arresting a dozen people and towing vehicles off the road. Over-policing and militarization by Enbridge-backed police in the North County is out of control, the GNU Collective reported on their Facebook. In solidarity, dozens of climate justice protesters occupy the Northeast Regional Headquarters of the Canadian-based Enbridge Corporation near Boston, Massachusetts. The occupation lasted a total of about 26 hours. On July 1st, direct actions continue to put a halt to pipeline construction. For continuous updates on resistance to the Line 3 pipeline, follow the GNU Collective on Facebook and Unicorn Ride on Twitter. Donations to the bail fund are also desperately needed. To donate, go to our show notes to see a link.
So what we're at basically is a all-out ground fight. People giving everything they have to defend this beautiful place and to stand up for future generations. I have seen over 500 people now passing through the legal systems in Minnesota. Over 500 arrests through the cold winter, through a pandemic. To put that in scope, there were 800 people arrested out in Standing Rock. So that's where we're at, even though this resistance has not been 10,000 people. It has been something where we've seen young people especially really stepping up to the plate. This is their futures on the line. Seeing 20-year-olds crawling into pipes when it's 0 degrees outside. Literally risking their own safety to stand up for their own futures and for someone yet to come. This to me is an extension of the fight that's happening all over Mother Earth, protecting the last beautiful places, protecting the sacred. As you were talking about at the beginning of the hour, climate crisis is ravaging Mother Earth. The decisions that we've made as humankind are coming back to us. And this fight is happening in the meantime for these places while the decision makers are talking, while the policy change is being pushed, while you have President Biden talking about being a climate president. Line 3, Trans Mountain Pipeline, Oak Flat, all these other places that are fighting, the Ferry Creek blockades, it's happening all over Mother Earth that we are standing up and defending the sacred.
Support for the campaign to defend the Atlanta forest is also growing. Here's a report from someone on the ground about their recent week of action. A week of action took place June 20th through 26th for the movement to defend the Atlanta forest. The movement has taken off as two project proposals threaten over 1,000 acres of forest in South Atlanta, Georgia. A vibrant and varied week of action brought out hundreds to spend time in the forest. Events included ecology walks and talks, movie nights, a Shabbat dinner, Kids Day, non-monogamy discussion group, hardcore punk show with several hundred attendees who got confrontational with the police, a forest rave that brought out hundreds to dance in Entrenchment Creek under the full moon, and a demonstration which resulted in a smashed window at the Atlanta Police Foundation offices. Firefly monitoring, educational classes, tree planting, a two-night encampment in the forest, and much more. City officials, the Atlanta Police Foundation, Black Hall Movie Studios, and major corporations are attempting to devastate the forest by building a major regional police training center, as well as the largest movie soundstage in the U.S. The resistance to these projects grows stronger every day. Follow Defend the Atlanta Forest on Instagram and on Twitter to keep up with the movement. This past week gave us a glimpse into the horrors that lie just on the horizon from climate change, as new reports pointed to the growing threat to the Arctic and horrifying examples of monstrous weather patterns. In the face of crippling heat waves across the regions like in the Pacific Northwest, which left hundreds dead and many more hospitalized, and saw literal firestorms rage across the sky, autonomous groups are mobilizing to provide mutual aid. This includes organizations like Symbiosis in Portland, Oregon, and Cooperation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, who are running cooling centers and water distribution hubs. Both groups have already been involved in the distribution of emergency supplies, including water, as Symbiosis has been working with rural communities in the face of ongoing water shortages following last summer's devastating fires, and Cooperation Jackson has been distributing water following massive hurricanes which knocked out water infrastructure. Check out our interview with somebody in the Williamette Action Collective in our next episode for a discussion on autonomous disaster relief in the age of global warming. As Biden doubles down in support of the police and the right and the neoliberal center attempt to play up misconstrued reports of rising crime, anger remains high as police killings continue to push many into the streets. In Lenoke County, Arkansas, protests broke out following the police killing of 70-year-old Hunter Britton, who was killed by a sheriff as he was fixing his car so he could go to work in the morning. In Elizabeth City, North Carolina, protests have continued now for 2 months strong, demanding justice following the police murder of Andrew Brown Jr. In Bloomington, Indiana, people took to the streets to march on the sheriff's office to demand authorities release the body cam footage in the shooting death of Malik Ali Malik, who was killed in a car chase with law enforcement back in April. In Minneapolis, protests continue in memory of Winston Smith, who was killed by federal authorities several weeks ago, and Deanna Marie Erickson, who was killed by a driver while protesting Smith's assassination several days later. People have been holding space in the area where both were killed, and last week people overturned dumpsters in the street and set them on fire as fresh clashes with the police broke out. An autonomous zone known as Smith Marie Square has also been set up that includes a garden, while back and forth with the city continues over control of the space, as well as at George Floyd Square, where the city and nonprofits have recently been successful in opening up the space to traffic. Events remain ongoing at both spaces. Follow Smith Marie Square on Twitter for updates. Last week in Portland, a man was shot and killed by police after calling 911 in an effort to seek medical help. People gathered at the scene to face down police, and clashes broke out when authorities attempted to violently clear the area. In a communique posted to Rose City Counter Info, an anonymous group wrote, "In response to the police murder of Michael Ray Townsend on June 24th, a parking lot containing multiple police bureau squad cars was attacked. A hole was cut into the surrounding barbed wire fence, and a dozen vehicles were hit. All cars had their windows, windshields, and lights and mirrors smashed, and abolitionist and anarchist messages were painted across their exteriors. A fire extinguisher was filled with paint and used to completely cover multiple squad cars, as well as their interiors. Every day the pigs turn the public spaces into open-air prisons. We call on all abolitionists to take defunding, disarming the pigs into their own hands." ICE detainees in New Jersey on hunger strike have been transferred. Recent direct actions have targeted the facility, tipping to blockade the deportation vans. As The Guardian wrote, "Abolish ICE New Jersey and New York, a coalition of organizations seeking to shut down prisons and immigrant detention centers, believes 39 detainees were on hunger strike before the transfer, and that among their concerns were their video tablets being taken away, preventing them from communicating with attorneys and families during this pivotal move." COVID-19 infections continue to spread at the ICE detention facility in Tacoma, Washington. Currently, there is a call-in campaign being organized in response. Members of the Industrial Workers of the World at Voodoo Donuts in Portland, Oregon went on strike in response to poor pay and conditions. Meanwhile, in Chicago, other IWW workers at a co-op grocery store are also going on strike on July 2nd and 3rd after management has refused to address worker grievances and unfair labor practices. sanitation workers in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, have also gone on strike to demand higher wages. On June 29th, workers blocked streets and began joining in solidarity with other locals protesting the police murder of Andrew Brown. And now for some upcoming events. There is a call for abolitionist actions from August 21st through July 9th, and on November 12th through the 14th, there is a protest called in Burns, Tennessee, against the White Nationalist American Renaissance Conference. Finally, if you value what's going down as a source of autonomous and revolutionary media, and you want to see us grow, and you want to support us, please give us a donation. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop. Again, that's itsgoingdown.org/shop, and please help us sustain this project and continue it into the future. You can also listen to us on the radio, tell a friend about us, follow us on social media, subscribe to our RSS feed, and also check out other shows on the Anarchist Channel Zero podcast network. That's going to do it for us today. As always, enjoy the interviews and the discussion, and we will see you soon.
Welfare for ending, the wealth they're dependent.
Okay, once again, we're back for another week. We have a lot of stuff to cover. We're going to dive deep into a couple of subjects. The first thing that we're going to talk about this week is this whole thing around critical race theory. We're going to be talking about how the right wing has weaponized this, how there's been kind of this eruption across the U.S. in different city councils and like government board meetings with the right kind of coming in and like using this as kind of like the thing of the moment and really pushing this as far as they can. We're going to discuss that, and then we're going to get into how this ties into attacks on voting rights and kind of like what's at stake with that. What are they trying to do? What does this mean? And is there any possibility that this is going to, you know, actually lead to certain things being impacted? And just to start off, we're going to start talking about critical race theory. And if you haven't read This Week in Fascism, number 142, going over 2 years strong now, there's a good breakdown on critical race theory and how it's really this kind of astroturf grift. I'm just going to kind of run through a little bit of this. But again, if you haven't had the chance to check it out, it's on It's Going Down, of course. You can click the menu button. It's in the columns. Right now, it's on the front page. So I think the first thing to keep in mind about this is that this is nothing new. A couple years back, if you remember, there was the push to proclaim that Sharia law was imminent in the United States. And actually, interestingly enough, just like with this critical race theory thing, there are actually a couple states that passed like bills and like, you know, laws against Sharia law, which of course is meaningless because there is no threat of Sharia law being implemented in the United States. But there's this guy named Christopher Rufo. So he went on Fox in September of 2020 on Tucker Carlson. And he's somebody that comes out of a lot of the right-wing think tanks. He currently works at the Discovery Institute, which promotes intelligent design theory, the Manhattan Institute, which is famous for spearheading broken windows theory of counterinsurgency and policing, and also the Heritage Foundation, which, interestingly enough, this is currently where Chad Wolf has gone to after leaving the Trump administration, and also Mike Pence has a job there currently right now, which is interesting. But they played an integral role in staffing the Trump administration. They had a whole list of people that they thought that Trump could hire, and a lot of those people were hired. A big example would be like Betsy DeVos. So when he went on Tucker Carlson, he argued that that there was this creeping influence of Marxism and, you know, hating white people, and it's called critical race theory, and it's being shoved down the throats of white children everywhere. And they kind of took this, and it's grown since it first went on Tucker, but by June of 2021, Media Matters reports that Fox had mentioned critical race theory nearly 1,300 times over the past 3.5 months. So it kind of grew and grew and grew as, in the wake of the rebellion, you had corporations sort of using the auspices of wokeness to sell their products or try to like get in front of the social movements and pretend that they're down so they can market themselves to millennials and Zoomers. Or you had, in some instances, like corporations and stuff trying to do trainings so they could like update, you know, their corporate culture so they could try to be, you know, with the times and stuff like that. So this is really a reaction to this. There's a really good article in the New Yorker that talks about Rufo and just like basically how he created this campaign. And Rufo actually talks about how critical race theory is, quote, the perfect villain. He says that, like, you know, political correctness is really an outdated term. Things like woke don't really work. Even cancel culture is sort of like not really valuable right now. But you say critical race theory, it's sort of like Antifa. It's like no one really knows, unless you're like inundated, like what that means. It sounds really bad. Maybe it sounds like sort of like Marxist jargon you might only hear on some elite college campus or something like that. So it's easy for people to write it off. But, you know, he issued essentially a call to arms on Tucker Carlson. And literally the next day, because he ended his segment on Carlson saying like the president should pass an executive order on this. And the next day he got a call from the White House. And then this guy is flying out, goes and works with the president, his staff, to create this executive order. And then soon after, GOP lawmakers are just rushing to catch up. And you have just a slew of Republicans across the U.S. trying to pass bills and stuff related to critical race theory, even though a lot of them, interestingly enough, seem to have no idea what that is. There was an interesting article that's in the Daily Dot where they actually talked to Republican lawmakers that had spoken out against critical race theory, and they said, can you define it? It was interesting because Ted Cruz said, critical race theory is like Marxism, but unlike Marxism that says, like, society is a struggle between the classes, critical race theory says that society is a struggle between the races, which is fascinating because that is literally what white nationalism argues, or, you know, sort of reactionary fascist, you know, racial position. And it says that, like, you know, the engine of history is not the exploiters and the exploited clashing with each other trying to gain supremacy. Instead, what we see in society is different racial groups fighting against each other to try to, like, you know, gain supremacy over each other or fight for resources. And this also ties into anti-Semitism, where instead of, like, you know, a ruling class that has ruling class interests that, like, governs over everybody else, instead you have this fictionalized, racialized version of a ruling class where you have, quote, the Jews on top that are, you know, plotting all these conspiracies and running the world and so on and so forth. But just to go forward, so much of this stuff has been astroturf. There's an article in Vice about the different kind of, like, stuff behind creating a lot of the content that Fox News has run with. Media Matters has reported on a lot of the guests that Fox News has had on that claim to be, like, angry parents that are really, like, GOP activists and different people in different right-wing groups. And I think the other thing to point out is that on one side, you have Republicans, which are screaming about how, you know, the left is trying to racialize everything. They almost have this kind of, like, libertarian, like, anti-identity politics thing that's, like, seems to have, like, some substance behind it. If you look at it uncritically, it's like, we don't want to be labeled as races. We just want to be people, and we all want to unite as Americans and blah, 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 which is all, you know, hogwash. You know, this is, as one opinion writer in the Washington Post put it, this is a new lost cause narrative. This is a new example of reactionary, right-leaning white people trying to say that, no, actually, we're the victims. It's because you're forcing people to think about the impacts of centuries of oppression and white supremacy and slavery and so on and so forth. But at the same time, this is happening. You know, anybody that's been paying attention, hopefully if you've been paying attention, it's going down, knows that the Republicans are more and more aligning themselves with white nationalism. You have the America First Caucus headed by Marjorie Taylor Greene, whose mission statement states that it believes in the primacy of white European, you know, Anglo-Saxon culture in America's fabric. You have people like Stephen Miller, who has essentially rewritten immigration laws in the United States that's based literally around race. And, you know, 10 years ago, he was palling around with Richard Spencer at Duke University, inviting people from VDARE to come speak. Fast forward to today, and he's sharing white nationalist articles. I mean, how is that not, quote, a critical race theory? When you're sharing articles from American Renaissance and VDARE, white nationalist publications, and then putting that ideology into law. I mean, it's racial theory that you're putting into policy that's impacting millions and millions of people. Again, another example would be, you know, people like Paul Gosar or Steve King going to the America First Conference organized by Nick Fuentes, who marched in Charlottesville, Holocaust denier, white nationalist, so on and so forth. Again, how is this not engaging in racial theory? I mean, how is this not identity politics, except for white people in a fascist direction? So on one end, while they're talking about how the left is trying to racialize everything, they're essentially doing that exact thing on a mass level in the Republican Party. So anyway, that's my TED talk about critical race.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's a lot of foundational sort of history to this campaign specifically that I think is really important to try and understand. And it allows us to sort of grasp where these narratives of about things like, quote, cultural Marxism and these narratives around race have started to sort of fuse into each other in right-wing rhetoric. So it makes sense to sort of I think, start with on a formal level, what is critical race theory, right? And as you said, it is a body of theory which attempts to, specifically in an American context, place race at the center of political discourse, right? There are lots of people that have made arguments in a bunch of different directions that are good faith arguments about that. There are definitely some pretty bad hot takes by some like Marxist types about why they don't think race matters and things like this. But there have been, you know, people like Cedric Robinson and stuff have issued some interesting critiques of this. But the response always, I think, is pretty simple and I think probably correct, which is that we can't understand class in America without thinking of that through the lens of race as a colonial project, right? That's a relatively simple basic thing that I think most millennials at this point would probably take as almost a normative given, that America is not a shining city on the hill, that America is not a land of equality, that this is a land of colonialism, and we have yet to really reckon with that history. That's all that there is on a very basic level to what is referred to as critical race theory. Now, what's interesting about that is sort of twofold. The first is, critical race theory as a discourse is one of those things which sort of formed up as something identifiable as a group of people that identified with that label in academia, right? And this is sort of like the post-Angela Davis types that are sort of doing a lot of really interesting work around the formation of concepts of race, for example. So unlike white nationalists or unlike race essentialists in critical theory, in critical race theory, the idea of race is not an essentialized category, but is instead a historical category, right? It's one that critical race theorists talk about as being constructed as part of the philosophical enlightenment in Europe, kind of prior to the American and French revolutions. If you really look at that historically, that's entirely accurate, right? The idea of whiteness was not a concept in Europe until Europeans attempted to justify colonialism and then later slavery. Prior to that, identities in Europe were nationalist primarily, right? Or ethnic, right? They're based on people deciding to have some sort of division based on something that they consider to be essential. When the category of whiteness was constructed, it sort of flattened out all of those national divisions in Europe and created one category. That category, though, within critical race theory is not something which typifies Europeanness necessarily, but in America, it's something which typifies access to power, right? So within critical race theory, the idea is that you take, say, Irish immigrants who, when Irish immigrants came to the United States, were not considered to be white people. There is plenty of propaganda that was put out in newspapers about this. Bosses very directly leveraged this as a way to break organized labor. And then eventually, the Irish, just like Italians, just like people from Eastern Europe, slowly but surely assimilated, and as they assimilated, became white. That's really the fundamental premise of critical race theory. It's not controversial in any kind of way. Right. And it's primarily a discourse that's academic, and it's one that has a lot of sort of ties to contemporary forms of doing history, as well as post-structuralism and more contemporary forms of theory and philosophy. But then there's the common usage of the term, which the common usage of the term bears almost zero resemblance to the actual reality of what critical race theory is, that when that term is used amongst the American public, generally that's meant to refer to any discussion that places race at the center of anything, right? But why are people so up in arms about this? And I think that this is really where we start to gain a glimpse into what's really happening here. Now, I think on one level, it's easy for us to say that a lot of conservatives are riled up about this because, at least subconsciously, this is a threat to their position within white supremacy, right? That as we actually reckon with our history of race and our history of colonialism, that has been undermining the power structure of white supremacy slowly over the course of many decades, right? That's not a fiction. that the white power structure is weaker than it was, say, 50 years ago or 60 years ago.
One of the other big developments that happened in the past couple of weeks, and this is also in the column, but Charles Murray was on the Tucker Carlson show, not the nightly one, but he has another one because Fox gave him another show, of course. But Charles Murray came on, and essentially what he said is that, like, you know, with all this rioting and people fighting, like, you know, if they push white people, we'll have to develop our own identity politics, which of course is a total joke. I mean, anybody that's looked at paleoconservatism, Patrick Buchanan, his favorite white nationalist ideologue, Sam Francis, who had the idea of the middle American radical, you know, people like Ann Coulter, who have for decades been arguing that basically that is the path to Republicans gaining power, which is doubling down on what she calls white identity politics. The same thing Sam Francis argued. And, you know, Charles Murray, of course, who is defined as a white nationalist by the Southern Poverty Law Center, who wrote a book called The Bell Curve, which is essentially the Bible of scientific racism and argues that non-white people have lower IQs than whites. And basically because of that, they perform in lower standards, more prone to crime, so on and so forth. This has basically been the linchpin, the white nationalists at the American Renaissance, like Jared Taylor and Richard Spencer, have basically built a body politic around that have basically created white nationalism as we know it, and I would argue also the alt-right, because they argue that non-whites cannot exist within, quote, white civilization. They bring it down, and therefore the races must separate, so on and so forth. I mean, this is all stuff that's been easily debunked. If you want to look into it, there's some links that are in the article. But, you know, lo and behold, a lot of the, quote, research that Murray used to make his point came from racist people that wrote it, white nationalist publications, eugenicists, you know, avowed white supremacists and so on and so forth. And lo and behold, of course, they argued that non-whites were below whites. But anyway, so he comes on Tucker Carlson and he argues the same thing. He argues that people with lower IQs perform differently, and therefore that's what explains people getting less wages, having less opportunities. And again, he makes this, it's interesting because he makes this argument across not only lines of race, but also across lines of class. So he says, like, you know, basically if you're in Appalachia and you're not doing so well and you're addicted to opioids, you know, it's your own fault. You know, you just have bad genes and you suck and you're just going to live a life that's horrible, and you should just be grateful for what you have and stop asking for more, because, you know, you as an individual just suck as you know, your genetic coding has designed you to do. And all these people from below that are asking for more are just disgusting creatures and need to be brushed aside. It's funny. I mean, we talked about this in relation to UBI, because Charles Murray for decades has backed UBI because he argues that all these people should be pushed off of welfare and any sort of government help, and that we should just give them a small stipend and just be done with them. But my point is, again, is that while they're talking about this boogeyman of critical race theory, here you have the Republicans doubling down on essentially literally white nationalist talking points. And I think that him having Murray on is a big deal, because essentially what Tucker Carlson is setting up is he's creating, at least for people that are in the business of creating talking points and creating what I call bedtime stories to feed to the rest of us, an argument why there's such entrenched inequality within America, because that's what's driving essentially all these recent revolts around austerity.
Yes.
White supremacy is this entrenched inequality, whether it's along lines of class, whether it's along lines of race. And if the Republicans can come in and say, like, well, it's not because of centuries of, you know, settler colonialism and white supremacy, it's because you have bad genes and all these people that are angry over growing wealth inequality, well, they're just a bunch of poor idiots, you know, in Appalachia or wherever that suck and they're never going to go anywhere, which, funny enough, are a lot of them are in, quote, Trump country, especially coming out of a pandemic, national rebellion that's been around, you know, inequality, both racial and class. I mean, for them, this is a godsend to basically just wash their hands of it and say, like, well, this is just in the genetic cards. What's scary about this is as we continue global warming, as we approach this new precipice where, you know, hundreds of millions of people potentially are going to be displaced and lots of people potentially may die because of this global climate change monster that's been created. This gives them essentially an out to just be like, well, it's not our fault. This is just genetics.
Yeah, well, and so, you know, outside of Tucker Carlson, your normal Republican, say, elected official or your normal Republican voter is not going to be that overt about it, right? That to be that overt about it is still in America to be a social pariah. And so instead what happens is that this discussion, which is very clearly about attempting to prevent a conversation about actual race in America and the way that that impacts everything that happens here, instead they have to frame it as this sort of cultural hijacking. And they use the language of, quote, cultural Marxism to do that. Now, what's really important about that language is, first, we saw them, the right wing, setting this up during the uprising. There was all of these articles about how BLM is run by communists, and look at all these people in BLM who are buying these big fancy houses. I bet they're really up to something because they're communists, you know. And there was this constant droning on about an incredibly reductionistic sort of fantasy world of left-wing politics that the right wing was presenting as existing. But the reason that they have to present it in that terminology is actually really fascinating. Again, they can't talk about it purely through the lens of race. America is becoming less white. Republicans, even right-wing ones, mostly recognize that they cannot win office based on white people voting for them alone. And so they're trying to concoct a new narrative. And what they've done is they've gone back into the sort of history of right-wing conspiracy theories, and they've sort of pulled language from there. So to understand what's happening, it makes a lot of sense to sort of go back to the beginnings of that narrative. And in this sort of discussion, it makes sense to start the beginnings of that narrative with the John Birch Society, for those of you that are not familiar, started off as a, quote, anti-communist organization in the 1940s that was comprised of entirely wealthy people. And when I mean wealthy, I mean millionaires or the equivalent of billionaires today. They were all invited by in person. There was all of this like secrecy and clandestinity around it and things like this. And really their goal was not anti-communism. Their goal was to take control of the U.S. government and to institute an authoritarian regime, right? And they were very open about this at the beginning. But as time went on, the John Birch Society became more public. They started recruiting. They started building chapters around the country. And they started distributing a series of newsletters and books. And those newsletters and books all sort of wrap themselves around the same basic narrative, which is that we know that there's communists trying to take over everything. And we know that they exist because we can see them in their discussions about race and unions and stuff like that. But we don't know who they are, so they're secret. And what that means is that every single person that expresses any sympathies that disagree with ours are potential communists that we have to go after. That argument, though it sounds really extreme, was the same argument that was the ideological foundation for McCarthyism. So McCarthyism was really grounded in this notion that there were unseen secret internal enemies that we had to hunt down and find and ostracize from the social fabric. And of course, what that led to was any person in any position of prominence expressing any political opinions that weren't completely mainstream being outed as a, quote, communist, and then sort of, you know, ostracized from their jobs and prevented from getting work and so on and so on. Moving forward, though, out of McCarthyism, you start to see the same narrative build up around the civil rights movement. And what both Southern governors, but also police chiefs in the South, people like Bull Connor, as well as the KKK, were all making the same argument. They were saying the civil rights movement wouldn't be happening if it wasn't for communist outside agitators coming in to rile up Black populations in the South, to make them angry and to put ideas in their heads that are going to make them fight us. And it was this kind of absurd conspiracy that all of the people in all of these Black communities all throughout the South and through a lot of the North too, that they were not really people with intentional agency, that in this narrative, they were really puppets of the communists. And that the communists are, again, the secret internal enemy that is infiltrating our education and taking over our universities and so on, so on, so on. So through the 70s and 80s, this idea persists. And, you know, it's articulated in a variety of different ways. But by the time we get into the 1980s, by the time we get to Reagan, the religious right starts to take this idea on too, but they frame it slightly differently. So instead of saying that it's cultural Marxism or communists infiltrating everything, what they say is it has to do with immoral heathens who are trying to make our children abide by the quote gay agenda, blah, 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 blah. It's the exact same argument. There's hidden people in the US government that are trying to tear down the real America, blah, blah, blah. And the religious right use this to mobilize sort of what they consider to be cultural warfare, right, is sort of the term that they use for that. And they did this by really targeting people on the grassroots level. They went after school boards. They went after local elections. They went into areas of the American political landscape where people don't really pay a lot of attention. There's not a lot of competition. You know, generally, if you don't live in a major city, you can run pretty unopposed for a school board seat in a lot of places. And so they were able to use this as a way to gain at least the image of some kind of power. They were able to leverage that to put policy positions, like policies in place that prevented protections for, say, gay and lesbian students or transgender students or Black students or things like that. And they were able to use this as a way to kind of rile up the base and continue to get them active. Moving through the 90s, this started to refuse with conspiracy theories that were being put out by the mainstream Republican Party. So by the time we get to 2001 and September 11th happens, the narrative of the secret internal enemy is already there. And so you see this idea of the secret internal enemy as everybody that disagrees with you and how that's been built up through decades of this narrative sort of perpetuating itself and migrating from the extreme conspiracy theory fringes into the mainstream of Republican discourse, right? We saw these very similar ideas articulated by the Bush administration officially, right? The See Something, Say Something program, for example, which was essentially a call for Americans to become secret police, to become informants on their neighbors, and to inform the FBI about what their neighbors are doing. The way that they framed that was they said, do you notice someone who looks out of place? Do you notice someone who's not acting as other people act in that area? Do you notice someone who might be speaking a different language, right? Like all of these things, which essentially come down to, do you notice someone who is not a conservative white person? And if you do, then that person's maybe a threat. Now, that narrative really focused on Islamophobia. But as we moved through the 2000s and we started to get into the Obama administration, this idea of cultural Marxism reemerged because there was this concept that Barack Obama was a secret communist or something, which again was an idea completely grounded in racism. And that's sort of where we find ourselves today, right? We have this kind of narrative which is rampant within the right-wing grassroots, which essentially summarizes down to every single thing that people that are not us advocate for is a communist attempt to take over America and indoctrinate our children. Everything. So if conservative white folks don't want to talk about race, any discussion about race is an attempt to indoctrinate our children into Marxism. It's an absurd narrative. It's an absolutely absurd narrative, which is made even more absurd by the fact that if you actually ask most of the people who are showing up at these school board meetings to yell at people from school boards about something that's not real, because schools are not teaching critical race theory in any kind of meaningful way. They're doing that. They don't even really know what they're yelling about. They can't define what critical race theory is. They've never really read anything about it that wasn't coming from a right-wing source. They can't even define it. But the way that they define it is they say, this is about liberals trying to indoctrinate our children, right? But they kind of can't really move past that point. And this is really where I think we have to focus our attention. I think the problem so far with this discussion, not on this podcast, but in general, has been that there's a lot of focus on how absurd the people showing up at these school board meetings are and how little they actually know about the thing that they claim to be experts in that they're complaining about. And that's fine. Like, that is a good thing to point out. However, I think what's missing here is an understanding of the roots of that. So we have to think of conservative politics in America. I think generally the perception of conservative politics up until the Trump administration was that outside of the fringes, most conservatives were people who were going to go to church and then vote. And that was it. And that largely was true. After Trumpism arose, what you saw was you saw this mobilization of the right-wing grassroots, and you saw that extend beyond the traditional right-wing activist base, right? So people that did that were involved in, say, like the Tea Party, that was a pretty traditional, pretty normal group of usual suspects that were coming out to that. There were just a lot of them because they were pulling people from all over the country. But the people that are coming out now are not those people. Those people are the ones that are trying to mobilize the people that actually are showing up at this point. And what we've noticed is something really interesting. And we'll get into how this ties into this discussion about voting rights in a second. But this whole discussion about, quote, cultural Marxism always has been a way to prevent America from having a conversation about race or to change anything in relation to the way that racial dynamics function inside the United States. It actually is absolutely nothing to do with Marxism, as you explained earlier. Critical race theory is not a class narrative, right? Except as an extension of a race narrative. And so what they're complaining about is this weird paradox, but it's a paradox which has been leveraged time and time again, along with discussions of things like states' rights, as a way to prevent people from, you know, American citizens from actually addressing the history and baggage of race in America and actually attempting to remedy that. Because at the end of the day, I think conservatives are actually aware, or at least conservative strategists and political theorists are aware of the fact that for us to deal with the history of colonialism in America is to destroy the American political project. That there is no way that we have that reckoning without the collapse of the entire American political project. It's not possible. We have to completely overhaul everything. And a lot of conservatives are aware of that. People like George Will were aware of that. Even people like Tucker Carlson are aware of this. This is why they're pushing so hard against this. But because they can't use the rhetoric of overt racism, they use the rhetoric of anti-Marxism, which is something which, again, has its roots in conspiracy theorists. Now, what's fascinating about the anti-Marxism thing is that the entire argument about Marxism, as it was articulated by the John Birch Society, is an extension of, you know, fascist conspiracy theories, which were anti-Semitic, which attached the Russian Revolution to Jews. And then, therefore, that meant that, you know, quote, Jews were controlling global communism, and therefore we had to stop it, right? This was the narrative in Nazi Germany that got picked up domestically in the United States by the John Birch Society. And that's where we find ourselves today. Now, again, the John Birch Society used to be really fringe. And I would even argue that this argument is very fringe. There's maybe, according to polling, 15 to 20% of Americans that actually think that something called critical race theory is being taught in schools and that that should be stopped. It's an incredibly small number of people comparatively that believe this. It's not even most conservatives that believe this. So why are they doing this? And I think to understand that, it requires us to step back a second and talk about some of the things that are going on around voting rights federally right now and sort of the debates that are happening in the Senate.
If the Republicans have their way, will that actually impact things? I mean, is this just kind of like political theater, or is this actually going to have a big impact on, you know, the political outcome? Like, a lot of people have said, you know, they will stop people from voting to a certain degree. They will win more elections, and then they will basically have a position to throw out whatever Democratic president comes in next.
Yeah, that's.
And then what in they 2 years, we're going to be stuck with Trump again or something.
Yeah, that's what they, on the surface, seem to want to have happen. There's a lot of reasons why that won't, that I'll get into for a second. But I think it makes sense to start with what is actually happening and what is the context of that. So what is happening is that Joe Manchin, the moderate Democrat from West Virginia, has proposed a Voting Rights Act that is meant to sort of allow the federal government to protect the voting rights of people on a state level by allowing the federal government to have some level of control over state voting laws. Now, the only reason that this is an issue at all is because in the recent past, the Supreme Court had thrown out elements of the Voting Rights Act, which had allowed the Department of Justice to audit state voting laws and reject voting laws which would have violated the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. That protection in the Voting Rights Act was put in place in response to the white power structure in the South, preventing black voters from registering and then turning up to the polls to vote during the 1960s and prior to that. And so when the Voting Rights Act got put into place, there was some level of protection. It did not get leveraged very often, but there was some level of protection against, you know, egregious violations of the Equal Protection Clause. After the Supreme Court threw that out, what happened is that all of a sudden, Republican-run states all over the country started passing voter ID laws. And the reason they did that right then was they tried to do that in the past, and they'd all been shot down by the DOJ because they're racist. And so they start passing voter ID laws, and they start passing, say, regulations about how many, you know, ballot drop boxes can exist in, you know, counties with a population concentration over a certain amount. And things like this are very, very intentionally meant to make it very difficult for people that live in cities, specifically people of color that live in cities, from voting. Now, they do all of this, and when you combine that with the way that they have drawn congressional districts on a state level, they're able to leverage controls like that to overcome the basic reality of their position, which is that they are a minority political party and they don't have the most support in the United States, and they're not the most popular political party. Their logic on that level, on the superficial level, is relatively simple. So they're blocking this bill by mobilizing the filibuster. And that's leading to a lot of backlash against them. People have equated this to Strom Thurmond using the filibuster to try and shut down the Civil Rights Act in the 1960s. People have started talking about how the filibuster itself is a tool to protect white supremacy. A lot of discourse has moved very heavily against what Republicans are doing on this level. And those critiques all center around one very basic question, which is, if you're convinced that you have the ability to really legitimately win elections, why would you be doing this? Why would you be getting fewer people to show up to vote if you really think you have support? And it's sort of, on a general level, making them look sort of absurd. On a state level, though, we have to think about how this operates and what the wider context of this is. So what's happening here for Republicans, the narrative that they're mobilizing in the Senate is that they're trying to protect states' rights, which again is another term that's analogous to protecting white supremacy, and it has been ever since the Civil War. And that is the context in which it is leveraged, right? So they're talking about protecting states' rights. They're talking about allowing states to determine how their elections work and so on, which is, of course, incredibly ironic considering that at least the entire first wave of lawsuits that the Republicans filed around the election were based on states passing regulations around voting or loosening regulations around voting. That when states loosen regulations around voting, Republicans have a problem with that, but then they argue for state control over elections, right? It's an entirely incoherent argument. It's the only way that they can make this argument without making it overtly about race. And so on a state level, we have to think about what's happening here. And to understand that, we have to go to Arizona and really think through what's going on with this, quote, audit that's happening. So the audit is absurd, entirely absurd. We've talked about all the ways in which it's absurd on this show at least twice. There are plenty of articles about it. There are plenty of articles about the guy who owns Cyber Ninjas and how he was interacting with Ron Watkins and blah, 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 right? All of these, everyone is aware of the problems of this thing. So why are Republicans pushing it? So they're pushing this in order to try and encourage Republicans in other states to do the same thing. And you can tell that this is the strategy because what they've been doing recently is they've been flying Republican politicians from other states that are run by Republicans into Arizona to sort of observe, quote unquote, the, quote, audit. And in that process, those Republicans are having meetings with Arizona Republicans about plotting strategy. There have already been discussions among, say, the Michigan Republican Party about trying to do the same thing. The Pennsylvania Republican Party is trying to do the same thing. There's a small town in New Hampshire that's trying to do the same thing, right? And ostensibly, the argument here that they're putting forward in public is we accept the results of the election, but we know that there was fraud. Right. How they know that there was fraud when there's no evidence of fraud is beyond everybody. But that's what the claim is. And that this isn't really about relitigating the election. This is about understanding how much fraud there is in our elections. Now, if we think about what this means that the people that are leveraging arguments about voter fraud to limit voting rights are the same people doing the, quote, audits that demonstrate the voting fraud. Right. So we all know what the outcome of that is going to be. It's going to be that they are going to, you know, use the results of these, quote, audits to then pass more restrictive voting regulations. What Democrats are trying to do on a federal level is prevent that. What Republicans are trying to do on a federal level is make sure that that happens. Now, of course, that doesn't look super great. If you are the political party that is doing that, that does not look super good.
Well, that's why they have to cloak it in all these conspiracy theories. But let me ask you
exactly.
Let me ask you one question real quick. And I mean, we obviously know the answer to this. But why aren't the Democrats making more of a big deal about this? I mean, literally, we're talking about the very basis of this supposed democracy. And people are just kind of like, ooh. I mean, why aren't they activating the base around it and getting people to at least make noise around this? They just seem it's like, you know, this is just some minutia that's in the process of government. I mean, obviously, they don't want to do that because the Democrats, at the end of the day, are more scared of their base than they are of encroaching fascism. But I mean,
yes. So that's one element of what's happening, right? So what the argument Republicans are literally making here is that elections are bad if their guy doesn't win, right? Which is fascism, right? That's having elections for aesthetic reasons purely. That's what happens in Belarus. That is literally the position Republicans are taking. So why aren't Democrats pushing back on it harder? The first reason I think that you mentioned is entirely accurate. Democrats are terrified of their base right now, and they have every reason to be. I know where I live, left-wing candidates are very much a threat to unseating Democrats in primaries in all manner of different levels of the electoral system. And this is happening in a lot of places where Democrats have been in control for a really long time, is that people are realizing that Democrat is a really broad general term, and there's lots of different kinds of Democrats, and they don't like those business Democrats, but they really like the socialist ones, right? Like, that's happening everywhere. And the more that the Democratic Party riles its base up, the more that that becomes the case. So on some level, there's this power struggle inside of the Democratic Party between moderates and what the media terms progressives, but are really kind of like left Democrats, right? Trying to jostle over who gets control of the party. But the second thing, and this has to do with this kind of power struggle, is we have to keep in mind that Democrats currently are locked into an internal debate about the filibuster. So what's happening with that is that 48 of the Democrats in Congress, at least on paper, publicly, are okay with at least significant reform of the filibuster, right? To kind of outline what that means, and I think this is important because this is pretty widely misunderstood, there is no law which lays out that the filibuster happens. The filibuster is a convention. It's an agreed upon rule that has sort of existed within Senate decorum for, you know, not forever. And it really started getting used mostly after World War II. specifically around civil rights related bills, and Republicans blocking civil rights related bills. That then picked up again when Clinton was president. It then picked up again when Obama was president. We're seeing it again now, right? This kind of leveraging of the filibuster as a way to prevent anything from happening. But there's two Democrats that are holding out. And those two Democrats are Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin. Now, Manchin's position is he wants to see mild filibuster reform, right? So you can't filibuster X, Y, or Z type of thing. With Sinema, her position is the filibuster is something that we're going to want later. And so therefore, we have to preserve it. Because if we want to use it later, if we want to be able to have a voice in legislation in the future when Republicans recontrol the Senate, then we're going to need this. And that if we don't have it, then nothing is going to happen, right? We're not going to be able to have things which would sort of function politically, which of course is ironic because they don't function politically currently. So they don't want to exacerbate that debate inside of the Democratic Party. We've already seen a bit of the Democratic base going after these two senators very specifically. In fact, just this morning, there was a protest at Kyrsten Sinema's office in Maricopa County where 10 people were arrested on purpose. There's a civil disobedience action where people locked down to the doors of her office and voluntarily got arrested, right? That is not a thing that usually targets Democrats. And so the Democrats are in this really touchy position right now, right? So what they've started to try and do, or what it looks like they're trying to do, is they're trying to, say, mobilize their base not around the idea of race and how race is tied into this, but just based on generic voting. Democrats want people to vote. Democratic voters should support that. Therefore, what Republicans are doing is wrong. It's an incredibly generic line, which attempts to ignore the entire history of this sort of discussion, right? And so Democrats are terrified of their base. But with Republicans, what's fascinating about this, to me very specifically, is that their position on this, just like their position in the critical race theory debate, and this is what ties these things together, is not a popular position. It's not a position held by even half of Republicans. And it's definitely not a position held by more than 20% of the American population. So why are they doing this? To understand that, I think we have to see all these things in aggregate, not in isolation as they've been talked about in the press, but we have to see these things in aggregate. We have to see these things playing together around a basic reality that Republicans understand, which, and again, we've mentioned this almost ad nauseum on the show, but they are a minority political party that increasingly is getting fewer and fewer votes as their voting population literally dies off. And so what they have to do is they have to mobilize their voters and mobilize grassroots energy in an attempt to turn out as many people as possible while also limiting as many voters as they can. So what they're doing in this context, and we can sort of see this if we look at it in aggregate, is the critical race theory debate, which they framed around this idea of cultural Marxism, is really about continuing the existence of the permanent Republican voter bloc, which is something that was a Newt Gingrich, Tom DeLay project in the 90s. What's happening with that is that Republicans are trying to divert attention away from the actual occurrences of things that are actually happening. Because the basic reality of the Biden administration is that is really boring. And that Joe Biden is not a communist in any kind of way. Joe Biden has been pretty fervently anti-communist his entire political career, and nothing he's doing even looks vaguely socialist. He's kind of just going with the motions and sort of doing things in a really basic way and not rocking the boat too much. And that's not a kind of politics that's easy to mobilize your voters around, right? Because you can't say Joe Biden does nothing, because then, of course, the implication is he should do more, which is not something that they want. But they can't also say Joe Biden's doing all these awful things because socialism, because he's not doing anything. And that's really obvious. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to say Joe Biden's over here, but really the Democrats are run by BLM, and BLM is about cultural Marxism, and they work with Antifa, blah, 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 blah. And the only way that we're going to stop Antifa from stealing elections is with these voter ID laws. And it sounds ridiculous. Because it is ridiculous. There is, I mean, this is a Glenn Beck conspiracy chalkboard of a swirling, absurd conspiracy theory, which actually is structured not unlike QAnon, where QAnon sort of at this point grows and shifts just based on people trying to find ways to resolve logical contradictions without any demonstration of any of what they're saying in material reality. This sort of narrative has sort of moved in that direction as well, in which you have this kind of cascade of conspiracy theories that have sort of become official Republican doctrine, which are relatively superficial and relatively basic and not particularly popular. But what they do is they mobilize their base. And that mobilization of base is incredibly important for their future strategy. So I think a lot of analysts have said, great, cool, Republicans are trying to bring up more voters while limiting Democratic voters. That's their strategy. And that's true on a federal level. But on levels below this, on a state level, on a county level, on a city level, school boards, things like that, the sort of mantra that has arisen that you've heard at all of these kind of like vaguely QAnon adjacent conferences recently, or that you've heard coming out of right-wing Republicans, has been this focus on winning local office. So this is not new to Republicans. I mentioned how the religious right did this in the 80s as a way to sort of impose right-wing Christianity as, you know, an official educational platform and things like that, using state violence to do that. What's happening now, though, is that they're sort of pushing down onto this lower level for a very obvious reason, if we really think about it. So outside of cities, major cities, a lot of these local seats, and we're talking city comptroller, school board seats, stuff like this, really nobody runs for those seats. John Oliver, a couple of years ago, did a whole episode of This Week Tonight about judges and how judges are elected in the United States often unopposed by anybody. There's no one to run. And so even in a Democrat-heavy area, you can have a Republican get elected to a seat like that. Now, of course, when a Republican gets elected to a seat like that in a heavily Democratic area, they don't get what they want, but then they can use that ability to not get what they want as a way to increasingly mobilize their voter base, right? What the goal here is to do is to build a sort of self-acceleration or a dynamic which sort of exists on its own inertia. And to some degree, that is happening. Right. The first element of that is to create fundamental cultural, social, and political separations. And the way that they do this is through this narrative of cultural Marxism. They say every single person that disagrees with us is a communist. And you can't support communists because communists are bad. And so therefore, you have to support us because if you don't support us, you're a communist. Right. In a lot of areas where, you know, Democrats are a vast majority, like most cities in America, that argument doesn't hold any sway. But once you get into the suburbs of those areas, it does, surprisingly. And it's actually why you see a lot of these school board, you know, disruptions happening in suburbs of major cities. Is people who live in those areas have sort of fallen into a bit of a political trap. A lot of people in those areas that did vote Republican or voted for Trump switched their votes during the last election. And what that means is that the people that are left there are not only actual real Trump supporters or actual real right-wing Republicans, but they feel like they're under attack too. And so they're going into these school board meetings. They're mobilizing everyone that they can possibly find across a pretty wide area to show up to create the image that they have energy and to create the image that they have numbers, which of course in the right-wing press gets covered as if they have energy and if they have numbers.
and talk about this new domestic terrorism stuff that's come out. And we're going to kind of pick it apart. I guess the way to start about this is that, so there was a lot of anxiety about what was going to happen in terms of how the Biden administration would approach domestic terrorism, especially with him coming into office, and especially after the rebellion, and especially after January 6th. So there was a question of how they were going to go about doing so, and also if they were going to sort of create like new legal infrastructure. The FBI was definitely asking them to create new kind of like designations domestically for domestic terrorism specifically. And they didn't do that, which is interesting. You know, there was a lot of people that came out opposed to that. Obviously, you know, we talked about it on the show. Everyone from like the ACLU to the NAACP to the SPLC to Alphabet Soup, you know, so on and so forth, said quite plainly, like, look, like, you know, creating more state entities like we did under the war on terrorism will not make us any safer. What it will do is give the government more powers to go after people, which it already is doing, which is largely left-wing, anarchist, anti-fascist, black liberation, water protector, you know, regular run-of-the-mill working class social movements. That's what their resources will get focused on. And, you know, lo and behold, they put out this new report on domestic terrorism, which really, I mean, honestly, doesn't really say that much new stuff. I mean, we've talked about a lot of these reports. I think, you know, honestly, the one that was the most interesting to me that we talked about, you know, a year ago or 6 months ago, I can't really remember, but I think it was from the DHS. But it was interesting because a lot of liberals loved it because it had like one line where it said like white nationalists or something like that. But it really basically said, like, society is crazy and that we just need more surveillance and repression everywhere because everyone at any instance could become a serial killer and that we just need to, like, watch everybody like a hawk. Which, I mean, from the vantage point of the state, is probably very true. And, you know, there's a lot to pull apart from that. But a lot of people focused on, they had this sort of breaking apart of like domestic terror threats, and it was like you know, basically based around the grievances that each of these groups had. So you had animal rights and environmental groups, you had, they called it like abortion extremism, and then you had this subset that was like anti-government / anti-authority, which they talked about, you know, militia groups, and then you had what they called anarchist extremism. And then they had a category that was racially motivated extremism, which they said like white nationalists and other people that are motivated by, you know, racial grievances. So there's a couple things to pull apart from that. First of all, you know, I would state that like the stuff about animal rights, environmental extremism, I mean, that's all like post-Green Scare. I mean, that goes back two decades, you know, when the ALF and the Animal Liberation Front and the Earth Liberation Front were seen as like the main boogeyman. I mean, people that were literally going around and freeing animals from like laboratory tests and like vandalizing, you know, fur farms. And, you know, the most extreme would be the Earth Liberation Front burning down, you know, empty buildings and stuff that are involved in different aspects of environmental destruction and so on and so forth. This is all like stuff that's like two decades old. But, I mean, you had a lot of industry giants that had a lot of money invested in everything from biotechnology to the fur farm industry to, you know, anything involving animals and, you know, the destruction of the environment with, you know, fossil fuels and stuff, pushing the government to create more laws about this. So, you had the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which basically said if you do anything that involves animals or agriculture, you know, to protest that or to impact it economically, you know, you're going to get hit with terrorism enhancements and so on and so forth. This, I think the Shack 7 were tried under this, and like several other people like Peter Young. Yeah, this is a real thing. I mean, this is like coming from, you know, agriculture giants. I think like APEC was involved in pushing that, or, you know, basically corporations coming together and creating policy and then taking that to the state. So, I mean, yeah, that is still very much there in the state's in the state's mind, even though it's been 20 years or so from the last big ELF action. The Green Scare happened right after 9/11, 2003 to 2005, and now it's been 15 years past that, and it's still basically harboring that. But I mean, again, that's nothing new. I mean, it's that language has been there for a long time. Anti-abortion extremism. I mean, I think it's easy for us to forget that, an anti-abortion activist extremist, put a bomb at the, the 1996 Olympics?
The 96 Olympics in Atlanta, yeah.
There's actually a really interesting documentary. I think it's called, Manhunt on Netflix, if you get a chance to watch it. But I think the guy himself, if I remember, was a former Klansman. They carried that out, and then he was went underground for a couple years and had help from militia groups, and people were singing songs about him. It's I don't know what his name was. I think it was Johnny, but it was
Eric Rudolph.
Right.
His name was Eric Rudolph.
Run, Eric, run. People had bumper stickers. There was a whole right-wing campaign to support him, even though, he did this heinous thing where he basically just put a giant bomb in the middle of this field where there was a concert and was going to blow it up and just be hey, I killed all these people because abortion's wrong. Therefore I killed all these people. But he became this right-wing, celebrity for a while and was this, it was a giant manhunt to capture this person. And anyway, so I mean, anti-abortion extremism is still, on their radar. And of course, there's been a slew of incidents where abortion doctors have been murdered, or their facilities have been burned down. A lot of that stuff happened in the 90s. And around that time, there were militant groups like Operation Rescue, which were kind of the above ground support of a lot of the underground stuff. But I mean, that was very much tied into a lot of the right wing, radical far right groups that was happening during that time. But I mean, again, that's still very much on their radar. What's new is that they've created this sort of category where they lump anarchists and far right militia people into sort of this anti-government / anti-authority thing together. And what they used to do is, a couple years ago, they had the designation Black Identity Extremists. And now what they've done is they've lumped this whole category of racially motivated extremism together. But what that really implies is Black Lives Matter and white nationalists. So they can basically say if they're asked are you doing anything about racial violence or hate crimes? They said, oh yes, of course, we're doing a lot. But really what they mean is that under this bracket of racially motivated extremism, they're looking at essentially left and right. And of course we know that they're going to look at left-wing movements from below much harder than, of course, the right. But does that mean that the state is necessarily changing anything that it's done in the past couple of years? I would say no. And they're definitely taking seriously January 6th. I mean, they're going after these people pretty hard.
Yeah.
I mean, just within the past week, there's been more stuff that's come out about the Proud Boys getting conspiracy charges. The 3%ers have been getting conspiracy charges. I mean, they're going pretty hard on these people.
Yeah, I think, a lot of the people I know have had pretty intense reactions to this. And so it makes a lot of sense to kind of contextualize, right? So as you were saying, on some level, this isn't new, right? There's not really a way to designate a domestic organization as a terrorist group. There's no laws around that. There's no legal code. What Christopher Wray, the director of the FBI, was asking for last time he went to Congress was for that legal code to be created. That would be a significant change, right? But up until this point, all it is a document, right? Now, it's a strategy document, and that is meant to sort of indicate a administration's priorities and things like that. It definitely indicates a prioritization of domestic politics over international issues. But in a lot of ways, this sort of harkens back to the days before September 11th, right? So after September 11th, though the hidden internal enemy was always present in that discourse, right? In that like super paranoid kind of discourse, the hidden internal enemy was foreign, right? That even if you were like a leftist and people considered you an internal enemy, it was because you were anti-American, right? Like, so there was a foreignness that was being presented. But in the 90s, that wasn't true. And, you know, in the 1990s, we have to think of the context that existed back then. But probably a lot of people listening to the show don't really remember that period of time. But for those of us that are real old, it was really formative for a number of reasons. But one of the things that happened during that period of time is that the right wing had a number of high-profile confrontations with the federal government and blew up a federal building. Now, of course, right after the Murrah building in Oklahoma City got blown up, the original first suspect that they, you know, released a sketch of and told people to look for was apparently a, you know, Islamic extremist, right? Now, how they came to that conclusion has largely been lost to history. We don't really know, or at least it's not public information. We're not really sure how that happened. But pretty quickly, they identified that this person was very likely domestic, right? That was very likely a white male, generally. And then a few hours later, they arrest McVeigh on the highway driving away from Oklahoma City. But during that period of time, there was this really heavy focus on domestic, quote, extremism. Now, during that period of time, as you mentioned before, groups like the Earth Liberation, well, groups is not really the right term. Affinity groups that use the name of the Earth Liberation Front and Animal Liberation Front, which were not actual organizations ever, they were just sort of names that people claimed actions under, were routinely listed in FBI releases every year as being the top domestic extremist threat. Now, they never used the word terrorism. They always used the word extremism. And they would talk about animal rights extremists. They talked about environmental extremists. And they would use those, quote, groups as examples of that, right? And they talk about militia groups and things like this. But the focus is almost entirely domestic at that period of time. And we're sort of shifting back into that. And you can see that, you know, in releases like this, you can also see that in the fact that, you know, the U.S. is actively currently leaving Afghanistan, which that war was justified very directly based on the shift into fighting international terrorism, right? That's how they justified invading Afghanistan. So we're noticing a shift back. Now, is this something to be super scared about, as a lot of people are? No, not really. Even though the rhetoric around extremism after September 11th focused on international extremists, the actual practice of the FBI, the majority of their activity was still domestic. Anyone that was an anarchist during the Green Scare saw that. Anyone that was an anarchist immediately following the Green Scare for the 4 or 5 years after that, experienced extreme infiltration, you know, feds targeting people to try and get them to become informants. There were police embedded into anarchist networks for years. Often people were really sketched out by those people, so they were kind of marginal, but they were still there, which of course increased the level of paranoia and so on. And so for some of us, we've already lived through this reality, and it sucks. And it sucked back when they were talking about international terrorism purely. So on that level, nothing really changes, right? Now, why would they even release a thing like this then? Well, I think there's a few reasons, and I think that these reasons themselves are more impactful than the actual statement. The first reason is very simply the primary political goal of the Biden administration seems to be to eliminate, quote, extremism. Now, the way that they talk about extremism is politically generic, which is a really important thing for us to pay attention to. So it's not just that they're lumping us into a category with right-wing militias and stuff like that. That's just insulting. But the actuality of this is that what they're doing is they're sending a signal to the right wing very specifically and to, you know, more radical elements of the, quote, left and post-left around who is considered to be by the federal government an extremist. That is intentionally meant to have a chilling effect. That is intentionally meant to generate exactly the response that it has. And it's meant to force people to freak out and sort of go to ground, right? Which is exactly the opposite of what we should be doing, right? I'm a huge advocate of operational security, but operational security does not mean retreat. And so, yeah, get more careful if you feel like you need to. Everyone already should be very careful about what they're doing. But this doesn't change anything, right? This is meant to send a rhetorical signal. The second reason that they're doing this is they're trying to please their base, right? So keep in mind, the Democrat base was completely taken by surprise by January 6th. Now, I think anyone that's involved in anti-fascist activity, that's ridiculous, because the right wing was openly talking about what they were going to do on January 6th for a whole month before it. Like, it was entirely unsurprising what happened that day. I remember sitting there watching that and going, well, yeah, of course that's what's going to happen. Why are all these journalists so surprised? It was so entirely obvious that that's what was going to happen. And so the narrative that's been crafted within the Democratic Party base, specifically the kind of moderate Democratic Party base, is the Trump administration allowed white nationalist extremism to get out of control. And that's why we were taken by surprise on January 6th. And so therefore, what we have to do is we have to crack down on the right wing. So part of this, and you can see this in the language of the actual statement, is meant to signal to the base that the Biden administration agrees with them and that that's what they're going to try and do. But the third thing, and this is actually where the impact becomes really important and where we can start to talk about these things in aggregate. Releasing statements like this within the sort of understanding of political dynamics that sort of predominates in places like DC is meant to signal policy priorities. Now, they're signaling policy priorities to people that deal in policy. And so people at think tanks, people that are legislators, congressional staff, stuff like this, and the tone of statements like that set the tone for those policy debates. So one of the things that I'm almost absolutely certain about is that after this statement gets released, there will be a period of time in which people like Christopher Wray will run around telling people about why we need new counterterrorism laws, and then the Biden administration will propose them. That the sort of general tempo, and this was not the case during the Trump administration, but in every other contemporary presidential administration, the general tempo is you present an idea to the public, you get a bunch of people to build support for that idea, you then push forward a policy, you then sign the policy, you then do the thing, right? Like, that is kind of how politics works on a federal level, with the exception of Trumpism. And so Biden is sort of returning to that reality. And so this does signal a legislative priority. Absolutely. I don't think that there's any possibility in which we leave this administration without there being new counterterrorism laws. The Biden administration has and moderate Democrats in general have a strategic necessity to eliminate more radical elements. And that strategic necessity is partially about self-preservation. They need to maintain a party base, and that party base looks really, really, really weak when there's radicals running around drawing people out of that base and into the streets. They also need to sort of cool some of these debates down, right? They did not necessarily handle the, quote, defund the police debate very well. They stabbed a lot of people in the back and made themselves look horrible to everybody. And so what their goal seems to be, and we saw this with the voting rights thing, where they're not pushing super hard in order to prevent internal conflict around the filibuster. They want to eliminate, you know, more radical elements, because more radical elements increase tension. And they create the possibility of conflict. And so if they're able to eliminate radical elements, if they're able to classify radicals as extremists, if they're able to then use this increasing counterterrorism power to deal with that, they've eliminated what is very likely their biggest internal threat to the Democratic Party, which is not internal to the Democratic Party at all, but has to do with the pull, the magnetic pull almost, of the revolt to specifically younger people within the Democratic Party. That if they're going to maintain their position as the party of the quote left, they have to eliminate the people who actually consider themselves leftists, or people that sort of operate outside of the left, right? People that are in the quote post-left or sort of autonomous left, or whatever they want to term themselves. So there is going to be something that comes down the pipeline. However, I want to make it really clear to people why I'm not particularly concerned about that. And the reason is that they already have all of this power. It's enshrined in the Patriot Act. They can already come into your house with a sneak and peek warrant when you're not here. They can already get your phone records. They can already listen to your calls. They can already get your email metadata. They can already do all of the things that they need to do counterterrorism investigations. That there's really nothing else that they need on the level of capability except for the administration to sign off on them sort of accelerating domestic counterterrorism. That is really what the FBI is pushing for. And they're pushing for this in a context in which they are trying to re-legitimize themselves in the face of a good number of Americans, because they were delegitimized almost entirely during the Trump administration. So the FBI itself has an incentive to sort of go after, quote, extremists, because that makes them look like they're doing something, right? For the entire political class, this sort of attempt at domestic counterterrorism helps to sort of solidify the center, right? People on the far left of the electoral system, at people like in the DSA, for example, or people that are sort of on the far right of the electoral system, so people in like the America First Caucus or something, neither of them particularly are super down with this, because they know that it targets their supporters very specifically. But most mainstream members of either party don't want those people to be involved anyway. And so the more that they can demonize whatever they decide to define as extremism, the more ability that the political center has to solidify itself and fortify itself and hold on to power. Because the political center is also dealing with the same crisis that the Republican Party is dealing with, which is that fewer and fewer people believe that the political system can do anything at all, let alone the political center. And centrists all over the country are losing elections and losing in primaries and getting shouted down when they're on stage at rallies and things like this, right? The center is not capable of holding on to power unless they're able to attempt to eliminate extremists, whatever they define as an extremist. And so on one level, everyone needs to be paying attention to this. This is going to impact us. It hasn't done so yet. Right now, there's just a document. It doesn't really mean anything. And as we saw with the attempt during the Trump administration to backdoor encryption standards, we know that with enough public pushback, that's not going to happen. So we need to be paying attention to this. We really need to be monitoring this, and we really need to be understanding the political dynamics behind this. But at the same time, this is another example, or I will say another call, for people to really get on information security and really lock down operational security. I know that doing things securely is inconvenient. It is, right? But so is the FBI getting your entire Facebook friends list. Because when they can start mapping your networks, I can tell you, things can get pretty bad. And the repression you will experience if they decide to do something with that information is going to be something that is going to be far more inconvenient for you, to put it mildly, than just doing things securely from the beginning. And so I really, really encourage everyone to start to lock this stuff down now. Don't wait until new counterterrorism laws are passed. Start using Signal, start using Tor, start using VPNs if you're not using Tor, and always, always, always use secure services or figure out how to use services anonymously. What we don't need is we don't need counterterrorism laws to be passed at a time when we are vulnerable as a community, right? We all know that at the end of the day, anarchists are an actual threat to the continuation of the American state increasingly every day as the anarchist community gets bigger, as we get more experienced, as we get more confident, right? We become a bigger and bigger threat to the continuation of the American political project, more so than even the right wing to some degree. They have a direct incentive to target us. And so we can't wait for that to accelerate. It's already happening. And we need to be preparing for any accelerations based on the risks that we already face. So I really encourage people to go check out sites like privacytools.io or to go to the Electronic Frontier Foundation website and look at the surveillance self-defense tool that helps you do your threat modeling and helps you sort of develop an understanding of what your security posture needs to be and what tools you need to use. Because though, again, this hasn't meant anything yet, we can tell from a statement like this what their priorities are, right? And again, those priorities don't necessarily change anything. But one of those priorities is very clearly gaining new powers. And those new powers will not be based on them building new capabilities. They already have all the capabilities they need. But it will be based on weakening the restrictions around certain kinds of information, such as banking information or healthcare information or information attached to sort of accounts that you have that companies might be protecting. All of this counterterrorism legislation is going to largely be centered around weakening those protections. That's what we have to be careful of, right? We are ready, unfortunately, too many of us put our whole lives on the internet. And we cross our fingers and we hope that someday things aren't going to get bad, right? But what we're doing is we're addressing the problem at the wrong place. We're addressing the problem from the position of trying to remove information after we've already been identified as someone that the state wants to pay attention to. We need to start way further down the chain. We need to be focusing on operational security from the beginning. Because when we do that, when we lock that down as a community, that is when things like this become less disruptive. That is when we can engage with attempts like this with more confidence. And that's when we can actually approach them rationally. Right now, what is happening is people are approaching this through fear. What we really need to do is we need to be approaching this through the lens of self-defense.
Yeah, a couple other comments. You know, similar other reports have come out in the past that have had the same modeling, the same exact same language, you know, discussing racially motivated extremists, anarchist extremists, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, this is how they define essentially certain actions. Like when that DHS report we talked about at the beginning of this came out, you know, the only example of, quote, anarchist extremism that they could come up with was when William von Spronson attempted to go to the ICE facility in Tacoma and set fire to several buses that were engaged in the deportation machine. He was shot, of course, and killed. I mean, that was their one example. So that was their example of anarchist extremism. Now, obviously, most of anarchist activity does not look like what happened there, of course. But that doesn't mean, of course, that is not on their radar. There's the famous case, you know, in Chicago where Funab Bombs was listed decades ago as a terrorist organization. And funny enough, when there was a report that came out during the protests and it listed like groups that the police were monitoring, and lo and behold, Funab Bombs was still on there. So, I mean, some of this stuff is just like you said, it's like stuff that's on their radar. And of course, anarchists are one of the things that are obviously mentioned a lot, and that's going to be on their radar. That does not mean that tomorrow everybody that identifies as an anarchist is going to be rounded up. Now, interestingly enough, you know, a couple days ago, there was another article that came out. The Intercept got a hold of some documents from the military, and it said that it was screening for, quote, terrorist ideologies, and they put on there anarchism and socialism and also neo-Nazis. So this was in response, I'm assuming, towards, you know, calls to you know, vet the military for far-right threats. Of course, they threw on their socialism and anarchism, and which is interesting because this comes at a time when, according to certain studies, you know, half of millennials and younger people identify as anti-capitalist, and of course, anarchists and socialists are the two most popular categories that, you know, anti-capitalists subscribe to. So I think the other thing to think about is that we need to be loud, public, and vocal about pushing back on these this labeling and saying, like, look, you can't criminalize an ideology. You can't, you know, say because people believe in a set of ideas that has existed for centuries, you know, that we're somehow terrorists. And how dare the American state, which is guilty of genocide, slavery, and imperialist expansion throughout the decades, turn around and say that we are the terrorists because we envision a world that's classless and stateless and based on cooperation, mutual aid, and solidarity. You know, I mean, I was thinking today about, I don't know if you remember this, and maybe some people listening to this won't remember it, but during the late 1990s, during the Clinton administration engaged in brutal sanctions against Iraq to target Saddam Hussein, who at one point was essentially a client state of the United States and received weapons and money. You know, Saddam at one point was seen as a buffer against Arab socialism and communism rising up, even though the Ba'athist Party essentially is like a fascist party. So at one point, the Clinton administration launched all these really aggressive sanctions, which meant that Iraq was not able to import, especially medicine and stuff. So they were essentially targeting Iraq with brutal sanctions in an effort to kill lots of people to bring Saddam to the table. And most basic studies of this show that upwards of, you know, 500,000 people or more died because of the sanctions. You know, lack of access to medicines, medical supplies, basic stuff. Lots of old people and very young people, you know, were literally murdered. I mean, this is one of the major things that, you know, the so-called Arab world pointed to on top of the United States backing of the State of Israel against the occupied territories of Palestine as one of the most egregious examples of American military power. And this was done, you know, through cold, calculated bureaucracy. And in fact, there was one incident where I can't remember that woman's name in the Clinton administration. I want to say Madeleine Albright.
Madeleine Albright, yes. Yes. Secretary of State.
Secretary mm-hmm. of State. And they were asked by somebody at like a town hall, they said, do you think, you know, how do you respond to 500,000 people being murdered through these sanctions? And she looked at them, and this is a classic moment in American TV and was seen as a huge kind of like, you know, oh my gosh, moment. But she said, we think that it's justified. And it was just like this cold thing where it's like, yes, 500,000 people have died, and we think that it's totally justified what we're doing in order to achieve something that in the end never really happened. You know, they didn't actually get what they wanted. It never brought Iraq to the table. And eventually they had to have this, you know, totally made up reason to invade Iraq, which is weapons of mass destruction, which was a total lie. And lo and behold, you know, a couple decades later, how many millions of people, both largely working class Americans that didn't want to go over there, were killed, and also an huge amount more civilians in Iraq have died, and the whole country is destabilized, and you have this stinking massive post-colonial project that's just totally gutted, and people are trying to put their lives back together. And again, I bring this all up because this is the state, I mean, we could use a million other examples, but this is the state that then turns around and says, like, oh, you're critical of this? You're a terrorist. Yeah. And yeah. This is the military saying, like, we're going to vet these ideologies. And not only that, but it's putting neo-Nazism, literally an ideology that says, you know that thing that the United States had a whole world war against? Let's have some of that. It's putting that ideology on par with socialism and anarchism.
Yeah.
I mean, anarchists never ran concentration camps. Anarchists never engaged in the cluster bombing of entire cities. Anarchists never built and maintained, you know, the mass deportation and incarceration of whole groups of people. You know, that blood isn't on our hands. That's on the state's hands.
Yeah. Well, and it points to, I think, the core of this discussion for me personally, which is that what counts as extremism in this context, right? Like that's ultimately the core question. And the answer is extremism is anything which threatens the continuation of the American political project or threatens the continuation of the state, right? That's not always a good threat to the continuation of the state, like neo-Nazis, but they are a threat to the continuation of the state to some degree or another, or at least that's what they're trying to be. And so extremism is defined as non-normative politics, right? And I think that that's a really important thing to keep in mind. Because last year, what we saw was we saw the state decide to more or less on a federal level suspend the rule of law, right? They came out, they endorsed paramilitaries going on the streets. They defended publicly people who shot protesters and hit people with cars. They essentially were using the right-wing base as a force of counterinsurgency. And there's a lot of cultural reasons why they can do that. But when a state suspends the rule of law like that, when we enter into the state of emergency, we see something really important, which is that law, though constantly American politicians are talking about the rule of law, law is a secondary category in relation to the idea of sovereignty when we're talking about the state. That ultimately, at the end of the day, the goal of the state is to impose sovereignty. Full stop, whatever that happens to mean at the moment, right? The state is a politically generic structure. When, for example, laws are instituted, laws are an appropriation of the construct of the state. And so they're disposable. The state does not need those to exist, but laws need the state to exist. And so in a situation like that, and I think that this is really the point I want to emphasize here, we already have watched the federal government exceed its sort of capabilities or its legal abilities to do surveillance, right? We've watched this happen time and time and time again. We've definitely watched the police abuse power constantly, over and over and over again. For those of us that live in cities, we see this literally every day, right? But that, quote, illegality is also the same activity which creates the foundation that allows the state to continue to exist. And so on a very basic level, we have to break this discussion down and talk about it from kind of core foundational principles, right? We are anarchists. Lots of people listening to the show are anarchists, right? Our politics is fundamentally in opposition to the continued existence of the state. So if the state is a question of using a logistics of armed force to impose sovereignty, of course they're going to come after us. Whether that has a legal foundation or not. And we cannot think of repression and counter-repression through the lens of law. Because law, again, is disposable. And when law no longer allows the state to engage in counterinsurgency, law is what gets jettisoned. So it's not law that's the category we have to care about here. It's not even the priorities that are the category we have to care about here. Again, we're anarchists. We should anticipate repression. That is inherent in some ways to the task at hand, that is something we will face, right? And as somebody who's been around for a long time, that is something that we face, right? Does not matter the context. There's always an underlying sort of track of repression happening all the time, right? That is a basic material reality, because at the end of the day, we are locked in a material conflict with the state. And we have to approach that from the perspective of not law, but from the perspective of what the state needs to do to crush sort of insurgent or radical tendencies.
I mean, even on the plane of, you know, you look at the far right who wants to, you know, basically use violence and use armed action to literally kill people. Like, we're going to start either a race war or we're just going to murder a bunch of people to destabilize things. I mean, that is in no way the same as like popular movements fighting, or what I would argue is that the Anarchist Project is to destitute the state in power relations, essentially, in capitalist society, meaning that we're going to make it void by creating something different and creating autonomous structures that are going to take over essentially the way that we live, as opposed to this world that we're supposed to live in. And I think in many ways that's more dangerous to the powers that be than essentially a force that says like, hello state, I'm going to kill you, which is like, you know, what the Nazis dream about, which is, I mean, in some ways is just like, you know, silly. Like, actually, there was an interesting quote that Biden said recently, like, you know, oh, you want to take on the government? Good luck. We have nuclear weapons. Yeah. You know, and this kind of brings it back to this, I think we talked about this recently on the show, but there was that, that like conspiratorial, like birther think tank, Center for Security Policy or something like that, where they did this whole deep dive into what they called like Antifa mutual aid groups in Texas. And it's like, why were they interested in that? Well, it's because the state failed and people stood up and took care of their own shit on their own. You know, but of course the state would find that to be a problem. I mean, the way that piece ended was it said like, we've got to do something about these mutual aid groups. Like, we've got to deplatform them or make sure that they can't get money. I mean, there was nothing to, it said like, it called for people to like give money to the Red Cross as opposed to mutual aid groups, but essentially it did nothing to address the material conditions which caused people to support mutual aid groups in the first place. You know, this goes back to the, you know, the thing that we always talk about with the CIA video about megacities. I mean, they don't actually have any solutions other than just more repression. And that in turn, I mean, if the state wanted to get rid of the anarchist movement, the best thing it could do would be to be completely progressive and try to get rid of social inequality in a real way. I mean, that would cut the wind out of its sails in a lot of ways, and anarchism would just be kind of like a, you know, maybe some people sitting around thinking about how to put John Lennon's Imagine lyrics into practice in a sort of utopian thing. I mean, now it's a material struggle that people are actually engaged in because the state and capitalism has entrenched these inequalities so much that people are forced to struggle against these material conditions and try to create something different. It feels real, and it is real because we're up against some very real things, and with climate change and everything else, and the very nature of the state to become more and more oppressive to protect itself. I mean, people have a very real imperative to physically change material conditions. So I don't know. Again, like, I would just encourage people, you know, go back and look at the stuff that's been written on It's Going Down about how pervasive under the Trump administration all the surveillance was. And a lot of it was them like fumbling in the dark, like, where's Cobra Commander? You know, where's Cobra Commander and how is he arming the Antifa cells at the border? And just like, you know, bullshit stuff. And of course, you know, 5 years later, they're going to list, quote, anarchist extremists along with all these other things, which are very real threats. But I think that we should take this again, and instead of just kind of like sitting with it and being uncomfortable, we need to, you know, again, have a dialogue with the public and say, like, why are these popular social movements that are advocating for a better world, that are about people coming together and bettering their own lives, why are they being listed alongside neo-Nazis and militia groups, which want to roll back the clock to the Confederacy or the Third Reich? Why are they being placed in the same, you know, document as both the same threats? I mean, this is the same both sidism that a lot of people, you know, were disgusted about under the Trump administration. And here it is once again.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.